This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you enjoy movie westerns, you'd probably like The Quick and the Dead, a western with a 90s sensibility. I know I liked it. The Quick and the Dead just came out on home video. On this archive edition, we have an interview with the director, Sam Raimi, recorded last February when the film was released theatrically. In this western, the mysterious gunslinger who rides into town is a woman, played by Sharon Stone. The town is controlled by a bad man, played by Gene Hackman, who virtually owns everything and everybody in it.
I'm confused. All I hear from you, you spineless cowards, is how poor you are. How you can't afford my taxes, my protection. And yet somehow, you've all managed to find the money to hire a professional gunfighter to kill me. Where's all this money coming from? What am I to think? If you got so much to spare, I'm just gonna have to take some more off you. Because you clearly haven't got the message. This is my town! If you live to see the dawn, it's because I allow it. I'm in charge of everything. I decide who lives or who dies.
Hackman runs an annual competition called the Quick Draw Tournament that attracts gunslingers from around the West. It's a series of showdowns in which the fastest draw wins a big pot of money, but all the losers lose their lives in the gunfights. Sharon Stone is the first woman ever to enter, and you sense her real ambition is to kill Hackman. Director Sam Raimi made his first feature film at the age of 22. It was the low-budget horror film Evil Dead, which became a cult hit that spawned two sequels. Raimi also directed Dark Man, which starred Liam Neeson. For The Quick and the Dead, Raimi talked with Sharon Stone, who also co-produced the film, about how they would change her look from glamorous seductress to toughened gunslinger.
We felt that we really had to strip her down, figuratively speaking, and remove the lipstick and the rouge and the hairdos so that it looked like she had no makeup on and just came into town as a much more plain-looking woman.
Weather-beaten.
Weather-beaten, exactly. Now, we all know that, I mean, we weren't going for an authentic look because, of course, women didn't really wear chaps and wear cowboy hats and guns on their hips and come riding into town as gunslingers. There were like one or two horribly murderous women back then who did use guns, but none of them wore this this getup that is classically worn by a man. Of course, the men didn't really do this either. It's all just a myth created by the movies.
Yeah, I love the point that you're making, you know, that all the male heroes aren't like authentic history either. So why not cast
a
hero as a woman? So do you see Sharon Stone's characters modeled on Clint Eastwood and Sergio Leone movies?
The movie The Quick and the Dead is definitely based on all of the work of Sergio Leone in his 1960s spaghetti westerns. And therefore, our lead character is based on his heroes. And they happen to be played by Clint Eastwood. But I don't think we were trying to model Sharon after Clint Eastwood, if that makes any sense. She was her own person with her own goal. And it's certainly a part that's been played in 1,000 westerns, and that is the Lone Rider comes to town to kill the guy that killed their pa. But this time it's a woman. It's maybe a role that was originally created by Kurosawa in his samurai films, with their riders coming into town to clean up the bad guys.
Now, are you a big fan of Sergio Leone movies?
Yes, I am.
One of the things he's done, or he did, I should say, in his westerns, there's this incredible fascination with close-ups. I mean, a lot of the iconic look in his films comes from the camera being really tight on really weather-beaten, often grisly faces.
That's right. He had a marvelous eye for detail, and he really made use of the widescreen cinema, and that is, of course, a much wider frame than it is tall, and most of the great westerns were shot in that particular format, and he, as you say, would come in for a super close-up a particular detail, a piece, a droplet of spittle of tobacco juice as it rolled down the chin of one of the town's worst outlaws. And when you watch that spittle roll across the wide screen, it's just, it's very, very dramatic.
Or somebody it's chewing big. A cigar or eating That's a right. cigar in one scene. So did you want to do anything similar with close-ups?
Well, in this movie, the feel of it was like a Sergio Leone movie, but we tried to keep the visual style away from his films. We just tried to approach each scene in The Quick and the Dead as dramatically and as differently as possible. For instance, there are about 13 or 14 showdowns or gunfights in The Quick and the Dead. That is that magical moment in Westerns where the villain and the hero square off in the sun-drenched desert street. They wait for that clock to strike, and then they slap leather like lightning, twin six guns, jump out and bark flame. And this happens so many times in the movie that we had to try and go about presenting each gunfight in a different visual style to keep it interesting for the audience.
So what are the different visual styles you used?
Well, one time for Sharon Stone's gunfight, when she entered this gunfight competition and her time came to face down the opponent, we decided to tell it as much from her point of view as possible. So that became the visual and the sonic attack on the scene. And that scene was shot with a lot of point-of-view shots, obviously, the things that she saw, and shot with a lot of close-ups of her face and how and we really tried to get into her head using the soundtrack, and that is when she had to listen for the click of the striking of the minute hand of the clock that designated the beginning of the gunfight when you could really draw, we tried to get into her head and screen out all the other sounds, screen out the wind and the crowd murmur and the dust scraping across her boot until she could hear nothing but the interior of that clock. So we really tried to be very selective on the sounds and play them as she might have heard them. Certainly overdoing it a little bit, because that's what movies are. It's blowing it up out of proportion. It's not a realistic approach. But in that way, we tried to make it different.
Your most talked-about shot is in one of the gunfight scenes. And without giving too much away here, I won't say who shot or anything, but somebody is shot through the head. And you can see, like, the horizon through the hole in their head. I think it's been called the Swiss cheese shot. That's how people refer to it to me. Like, what did you think of the Swiss cheese shot is the way it's usually asked of me. At the video store, I got asked that just the other night. And I think it's a controversial shot because some people think of it as being really over the top, too cartoonish for this particular film. And other people think, wow, that really makes the movie. Tell me your impression, why you did it.
Well, there is an old... this movie, The Quick and the Dead, is telling a story of this character that rides into town, but it's a 90s take on all the Westerns we've seen before. Now, a lot of people have a problem with that because the Western is a revered story genre for Americans. When you mess with it, which I did, and I took things too far sometimes, it sometimes upsets people or unsettles them because it is supposedly the story of our beginnings. Of course, the West was a bloody and horrible massacre of innocence, and it wasn't really the noble picture painted by Hollywood, but it's what we would like to believe. So when you mess with that, it's getting on touchy ground. And this movie felt... we felt that we had to update it and take a 90s sensibility. And that was to say to the audience, we're aware that these are cliches and we've seen these before, but here's a new angle on it, or here's a new pace to it. And here it is presented with a new cutting style and a filmic style of the 90s, and with a wink too, because we're aware of how silly these conventions are also.
I guess it's Sam Raimi, and he directed the new film, The Quick and the Dead. He also directed Evil Dead and Army of Darkness and Darkman. Is this the first film where you've had to work with a lot of horses and gunplay? I mean, I know you've worked with chainsaws. but, you know, this kind of real show-off gunplay style, did you ever work with that before?
Well, I've worked once before with horses. I don't like horses.
What, an Army of Darkness?
Yeah, they don't listen to me.
Right. No respect for the director.
And they always upstage the actors, you know, shooting a kissing scene, and there'll be a horse in the background shaking its head and going, oh, boy. Just trying to upstage the actors. I'm about to call action. I say, ready, and the horse takes off because it rehearsed it a few times, and it knows it anticipates the cue, you know. And horses are good basically for, you know, Elmer's glue and burgers in the south of France, in my opinion. But I don't like them. They mess up the street.
What about gunplay?
Well, most of the pictures that I've made are monster movies, B movies, and usually that's one weapon you pull out to fight the monsters. But I don't usually make big gun movies, but Quick and the Dead is really a gun picture. It takes place in a time when the old cap and ball system of guns were going out, and this is still when they had these single action revolvers versus the double action revolvers they have now. That means you have to pull the hammer back, click, and then pull the trigger, bang. You couldn't just pull the trigger like you can now. That's what we have now, these double action. But first of all, let me say I don't know a thing about guns. I'm just kind of spitballing what I learned from Thel Reed, the fastest gun in the West. But this was a time when they were doing conversions between the cap and ball, when guys would actually pack their bullets in the chambers of their guns, little balls of steel or lead and the gunpowder together, and they'd make their own bullets, so to speak, in the gun. And the cartridges, or the bullets, the shells that were came complete, and you could just snap into the gun. So this movie, boy, this is a long-winded answer. This movie.
Oh, you're really into it now.
This movie shows cap and ball guns, conversion guns, guns that were cap and ball and converted to a more modern-day type of gun, and a modern single-action cartridge gun where you could actually put the shell in the chamber.
But this is also the kind of gunplay where, you know, somebody has to, like, twirl it around their fingers or jump backwards onto a horse, do a somersault, and then shoot a target. You know, all that real show-offy, fancy kind of stuff. So,
absolutely.
Did all the actors have to get trained, or did you have stunt guys doing it? And did you feel that you had the eye to figure out what was a convincing gun stunt?
I didn't feel that I had the eye to figure out what was a convincing gun stunt, actually. But we were fortunate in that we called upon the services of the fastest gun in the West. That is Thel Reed. And he holds the quick draw championship, world's record. And that is he can pull a single action revolver out of his holster, draw and fire, hit a target with a certain amount of accuracy in the shortest amount of time. And he holds this record. And we got him to train all the actors in The Quick and the Dead on gun drawing and firing and a different style for each of the actors. For instance, Sharon Stone was taught one particular style versus Gene Hackman, who had his own cool and deadly style. You very seldom see Gene Hackman spin a gun in this movie because it's too flashy for him. He's much too powerful for that.
Right.
But for a show-off like the part of the kid, which Leonardo DiCaprio played, he's nothing but all silver guns with a lot of flash and a lot of spinning.
My guest is Sam Raimi. He directed the film The Quick and the Dead, which just came out on video. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with film director Sam Raimi. You said something really funny in a print interview a few years ago. You said it was your ambition to make a movie that would play in a theater that you weren't afraid to go into.
That's right.
Did most That's of your right. movies play grindhouses?
Yeah, most of my pictures are B-movies, and they play, you know, schlocky houses. And I love going to them in those movie theaters, you know, and it's theaters where your feet stick to the floor with the jujubes that are all stuck there, and half the seat is falling off, the armrest. But
you go to the bathroom at the risk of your life.
That's right. They're very dangerous houses, but that's where those B-movies play, and those are the kind of movies that I make, really. But That's you also get something when you go into those houses. You get an audience that is not afraid to scream at the screen and really get involved in this movie. They don't have any pretense about being ladies or gentlemen. They just want to interact with this movie with raw fury or abandon, and it's a great experience to be a part of that, especially if you're the filmmaker and you've had something to do with creating that entertainment.
Did you ever see one of your horror films with an audience whose reaction upset you. And what I'm thinking of, an audience who's hollering, yeah, kill him, get him, or you know, encouraging the decapitation of somebody or the rape of a woman or whatever.
The audience never reacts the way I expect them to. Mm-hmm. So I'm always surprised at that. But I've never really had the audience jump on the monster's side in my B-horror movies.
Really?
And not really.
Because so many times when I've seen a horror film, I've been in an audience where the enthusiasm seems to be for the monster or the killer. And sometimes that's kind of fun. Sometimes I find it very disturbing.
I've seen that in the first Freddy movie,
mm-hmm.
Where the audience is rooting for Freddy. So I know what you're referring to in other pictures. And I've often wanted to stand up in front of the audience and say, no, no, folks, you got it wrong. Freddy's the bad guy. I've seen that, too. But it's kind of because they've made Freddy into this pop. It's a different way to approach it. He's like this pop counterculture hero, you know. And I don't like that either. I find that very confusing and upsetting. But I've never experienced it in my movies, mainly because I don't really have a focus for the evil. It's usually this dark and unseen thing.
Right. It's a presence as opposed to a physical person.
It's harder to root for something like that, I think. Maybe that's why.
Mm-hmm. Right. Maybe that is why. No, I know a lot of directors have said that they started off making horror movies because that was the way to make a cheap film, and a cheap film that might get noticed. Now with Sundance, I think a lot of people who might have started off making horror movies make their personal coming-of-age film based on Mean Streets. that'll get shown at Sundance. Did you do horror films as a way to get noticed or because that's the genre you loved?
I had never really liked horror films when I made my first horror movie called The Evil Dead. I learned how to make them by watching them in a drive-in for a year, because I felt that was the only kind of a picture, no matter how badly we made it, we could still get to play in some movie theater or some drive-in theater. Because the movies were so bad in those drive-ins back in the late 70s, I thought, I know I can make something, you know, as good as this if I really work on it. So I made a horror movie because I felt I could finally get it seen on the big screen. And I was more concerned with the finance. I knew I'd have to raise money from investors, and I felt the only way to return that money to them would be to make a movie that actually played. So it turned out that a horror movie, for me back then, was the way in.
Did you have any hobbies or interests when you were young that the adults around you thought of as weird preoccupations?
I used to rehabilitate ants, and my parents never approved of that.
How would you do that?
I'd capture them in acorns, and if they escaped, they were punished. And if they endured their confinement for the proper amount of time, then they were released as rehabilitated citizens. They never liked that, though.
What would you do to punish them?
I can't go into it.
Oh, gee.
It was very severe.
Was this your practice to becoming a director?
No, that was the one thing I did, I think, that you know, I don't know. Maybe my parents didn't approve of, or that adults didn't approve of. I quickly outgrew that, though.
Uh-huh. Did you collect comic books when you were young?
Yes, I had a great comic book collection when I was younger. I have about 3,000 comic books. They were really good training for me visually, because the comic book artist has to choose the one moment in the story or in that scene that best depicts what's happening. So he has to draw a picture, choosing that instant that best tells the story. And it was a very good training for drawing storyboards, which are shots, basically the drawn version of the shots of a movie.
Which kind of comics did you like the most?
Well, when I started reading comic books, I read Batman and Superman. They were very simple stories of good and evil. And then when I got to be about 10 or 11, I started to read the Marvel comic books, which were just great. The Stan Lee's work, where he had a Spider-Man who had problems, you know. He had to fight the bad guys, but he also had a problem with his girlfriend. She didn't understand him, and his homework had to be done.
Do you think the visual style of comics affected your visual look in your films?
I think that I would take from comic books the fact that they would go for a very dramatic, graphic approach mm-hmm. in the visuals. And that's how I approach the visuals in the movies that I make. Not laid back.
Right. Okay. Now, what direction do you want to head in the future? Now that you've made a more expensive film with movie stars, where do you want to head next?
Well, I'd like to try and make a picture that uplifted the audience and left them with a real charge, a real feeling of having their spirit soar.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. It's unlike you, too.
I want to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like I'm pigeonholed. The only thing that's holding me back is either my lack of ability to do that or, it's time to do that. I really want to do that. I want to have that positive effect on the audience.
Well, tell me why you want that.
Because I really have always, I think I'm just discovering that that's what I've always wanted to do. And when I make a joke in a movie, in one of the Evil Dead movies, and the audience laughs, I love that. Then I think, well, what's really behind it, what I'd really like to do is to take it a step further, not just make them laugh, but uplift them, the feeling about themselves or their point of view on a particular story or character, and let their spirit soar if it's possible. And I know it's possible because I've felt that in movies. And I've been afraid of approaching that because I know you have to really be in touch with yourself, and you've got to really be a craft, very technically adept at how to tell a story on film and how to work with the audience. I may or may not be ready for it, I mean, as far as a craftsman, but I'm going to try and do that.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being on your show.
Sam Raimi recorded last February when his film The Quick and the Dead was released theatrically. It just came out on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.